Now, let me see. You two, we gave you the exclusive with the album a few weeks ago on a Tuesday night, just when we had it. And then we also gave you the exclusive with the interview a few weeks ago to Bono, taking us through every track and an awful lot more besides to Apple, etc. So there's two new songs released with the vinyl copy and the CD copy that comes with the album this weekend, Songs of Innocence. And there's acoustic stuff as well. I'll give you one of those. Loads of the acoustic tracks, loads of tracks from the album that are kind of done, stripped down acoustic. And there's other stuff, 12-inch mixes, etc. All the rest of it with the vinyl and with the CD. So I want to take a look at those two new tracks because they do have a great story behind the two of them. So I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll start here. Now, I did this in Bono's house and you can hear he lit the fire because it was getting cold and you can hear the fire kind of blazing away in the background. So I'll give you a bit of that first, just talking about this one. This song here called, as you know, all the songs are all about the 1970s growing up in Dublin, and there's no difference between these two here. They both are the exact same on that level. So in terms of autobiography, this one here is about a club in Dublin that was a kind of a rock place type thing where they played, and I was the DJ there in the late 70s. It's called McGonagall's, but it used to be called the Crystal Ballroom, and that's where his parents used to go. But anyway, I'll let him say all this. Let's start off with all this bit.
The physical release of the album, what's extra about that, or what's on it?
There's two new songs. One called Crystal Ballroom, which might interest you, because Crystal Ballroom was the name McGonagall's was known as in the 50s. You knew it as a punk club in the 70s. That's how I know it, and you two played there. And I've just played with the idea that my mother and father were there when you two were playing those gigs, because they used to go and date there. I thought it was an interesting idea, that we are the ghosts of our parents' love. We're what's left behind when they disappear.
The Crystal Ballroom is what it's called. That's one of the two new songs on the Songs of Innocence CD and vinyl release from U2 of the album this weekend. It's about 17 minutes now past the hour of 11 o'clock on this Saturday morning. Frank, how you doing? Are you all right?
I am, Dave. How are you?
I'm very good indeed. Now, I'll tell you, I'm going to go into the other song by U2 in a minute too, and there's a good story behind that one too, and I'm going to go into the acoustic stuff too, and Bono will be talking about that. But I did say there's a good story about this thing, the Crystal Ballroom, right? Frank Murray here is a man who's been involved in Irish music, or music in terms of rock stuff, all down through the years. I always see you at the forefront of kind of the Irish in London in so many ways. Obviously, most people would know you as the manager of the Pogues and all the rest of it. But Frank, I mean, the thing is, when I was DJ there, 78, 79, I think U2 played there about 10 times in 78. I know they did a thing in 79 where they did a thing called Jungle Balls or something, which is a Christmas thing in the middle of June, all that kind of thing. I remember all those gigs, and every single band passed through McGonagall's, all the rest of it. But Terry O'Neill was the manager of the club at the time, and I said, like, who owns this place? And he said, a guy called Bill Fuller. I said, who's Bill Fuller? He said, well, he's a prospector in California, which really piqued my interest. Like, wow, a prospector in California. Now, I've never met Bill Fuller, but it's an amazing story, and I want to know the story behind this guy. So you knew Bill Fuller, right?
I did, yeah. Yeah, I knew Bill fairly well, and I worked for him in London.
Yeah, exactly. Now, just tell me the story of him. What is he and who is he?
He was a Kerry man who moved to London, I guess, the late 40s, I think, or something like that. And he went into the construction, or more demolition, actually, in London, you know. they're used to be saying that what the Luftwaffe didn't knock down in London, you know, Bill Fuller did. Mm-hmm. And so he went around in the construction business, but somehow, and I don't know how he did, he became involved in show business. And I think what he did was he started to open ballrooms wherever the Irish were, you know, London, Manchester, yeah. Boston, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and all that kind of stuff. When there were huge amounts of emigrants out there in these places. So that's what Bill started to do, was just build ballrooms for the Irish to go and dance at, you know.
And he owned a lot here in Ireland as well, didn't he? Some of the biggest ones, like the old Sheeling and all those places.
He did. He had the old Sheeling, the Crystal. I think he owned the place on Parnell Square. Was it the Iron?
All right,
yeah. He owned a lot of Parnell Square. And he had Chuck Furbo over in Galway. Yeah. And that was his as well, you know.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So listen. So there was a big, colourful Kerry man. He had gone to London, and like the kind of guy he was. I mean, he suddenly started going to Las Vegas and everything went kind of weird. And the last bunch of years of his life, he died about the age of 90 a few years ago, were just absolutely bizarre. But before I get to that, when he was in Vegas, he fell in love with Vegas. Kind of. Did he get the show bands to go to? Is that why when we hear that Brendan Boyer had a residency, that was him?
Yeah. He organised that. And there's something weird about Bill in so much as, you know, Vegas in those times was run by the Mafia, and everything went through the Mafia. So how he managed to get bands into ballroom or into hotels over there is beyond me. You know what I mean? He must have been the only non-mafia person to be able to do that. So he had people like, I think it was the Royal Showband or the Big Eight or whatever, and he had them playing in the same hotel that Elvis used to play at. Right, they'd be playing in the lounge, yeah, you know, doing a bit of an Irish thing and a few rock and roll songs, I suppose, and stuff like that. And Elvis would be in the main room, you know, playing. So they all used to hang with Elvis, you know what I mean? Brendan Boyer and all that. And I think Twink was out there as a singer with them as well. You know, they all have very good Elvis stories. But how Bill got on in Vegas, I don't know, but he was one of those characters that... He was such a strong man. He was a charming man as well.
Yeah, people said he was a good guy, a nice guy, and all that. But you wouldn't cross him.
No, you wouldn't want to. You wouldn't want to cross him. You know what I mean? He was. He stood up for himself. He wouldn't let anybody bully him, and I mean anybody. You know what I mean? And if you'd done him a wrong, you know, he'd make sure. You know, that you knew about it, you know what I mean? That he knows, you know, that's what you were trying to do to him, you know. So you wouldn't want to cross him, but he was like a big gentle bear, you know what I mean?
And that place in London that he started off doing the thing, is that the Electric Ballroom now? It's still there?
Yeah, that's still there. It was originally called the Buffalo, I think.
Yeah.
And again, it was a place for Irish people to go. I think most of them were simply from the west of Ireland that sort of went there. But that was a mad place, and when he took it over, you know, it was infamous for fights, and you know, like in the 50s, you know, drunken fights and all that kind of stuff. He took it over and he cleaned it up. You know what I mean? He more or less told the local police, look, when he took it over, he had to ask their permission to reopen it, and he said that if he ever had to come to them for help, he'd close the ballroom down himself. So he kind of ruled that with an iron fist.
And like, I mean, the Electric Ballroom, everybody from Joy Division to the Clash to the Smiths to Oasis, did the Pogues play there? Yeah.
Yeah, the Pogues played there a couple of times. We had it with. He asked me to take it over from the Carousel. You know, a lot of his ballrooms were called the Carousel for some reason. He had one in Manchester as well, and he had some in San Francisco. And I changed it to the Electric Ballroom, and I got we had an opening night for the Greedy Bastards, which was
Phil Lynott and the Sex Pistols.
Pistols. And then our next gig was the Vicious White Kids, which was a band with Sid Vicious and a few guys from the Damned and Glenn Matlock from the Pistols as well. Oh, yeah. And then Sid went off to... It was to get money to go for Sid to go to New York. So he went off to New York and then died, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was his last gig there.
Yeah.
But another interesting story was the famous Fillmore West.
Yeah, didn't Bill Fuller own the Fillmore West and the Fillmore East at one stage? Weren't they
No. He owned... The Fillmore West was a Carousel ballroom.
Right.
And Bill Graham had lost a lease on the original Fillmore.
Yeah.
So he needed another premises, and there was a ballroom there. So he found out this Irish guy owned it, and he hopped on a plane to Shannon Airport. He met Bill Fuller in a lounge there. They drank a bottle of Jameson, and Bill Graham got on the plane and went back with the lease, and he went to the Fillmore West at the Carousel in San Francisco.
All right, well, look, this is the guy. Like, when he went to Vegas, he didn't even want to meet Elvis Presley. He wanted to meet Colonel Tom Parker, the manager. He's that kind of guy. So basically, he created an empire, entertainment venues all across the globe. Camden Town in London was the big one, I suppose, in some ways. He did have a thing for the Fillmore East and Fillmore West, etc. But he owned the old Sheeling, as I mentioned, the Atlantic in Tramore. By the way, another one here, you mentioned Chuck Verbo in Galway, but there was the Atlantic in Tramore as well. But anyway, just all these places that he did and all this kind of thing, he never lost sight of who he was from Kerry. Finog is where he came from, so the townland of Finog, it seems. But the point is that, like, with the Crystal Ballroom, which is what we're talking about here, which is what is in the U2 song, with McGonagall's, in other words, that kind of a place. Like, I mean, did he have any interest in it when the rock bands started being the thing, as opposed to the show bands of the 50s and 60s?
Well, he knew when the show bands days were up.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He knew, because you're just dwindling crowds and stuff like that, and then... Well, it started off with about 10 beat groups, mainly in Dublin in the 60s, were starting to get bigger and bigger. So he also knew the money was going to be in rock music, you know. I mean, when he had the Crystal Ballroom, at some stage they used to allow groups to play there on a Sunday afternoon, you know what I mean, in the mid-60s.
Right.
And you'd have a Sunday afternoon show there. But it was funny, because if you tried to get in there at night, they wouldn't let you in because you had the wrong clothes.
Because you had the wrong clothes. You were from the beat generation or something.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's get up then to the final bits, because the reason he hit the headlines in this century is a bizarre situation. I mean, first of all, I thought it was bizarre enough when I was there that he had silver mines or whatever, that he was prospecting for gold. And it turns out he had bought loads of old mines, disused mines in Nevada from all around the area. Which is bizarre. But anyway, he had this thing which he bankrolled a Las Vegas stripper. What's the full story of that?
This was a woman called Sandy Murphy. And she was involved with... there was a guy called Benny Binion who owned the Lucky Horseshoe, I think it was, in Vegas. Las Vegas. And he was a Texas gangster. But he was very famous for, like... he had the highest stakes, you know what I mean? They really had no ceiling on the stakes you could play for there, you know what I mean, in Las Vegas. So after he died, his son took over the empire and stuff like that, Binion's son. And this woman somehow got involved with Binion's son. Anyway, he ended up dying. I don't know whether it was from heroin. He was into all kinds of drugs. So she was suspected of murdering him. Her and her, someone who was supposed to be her lover.
Not just suspected, but charged.
She was charged and convicted, but then they went to appeal. And Bill Fuller, out of nowhere, someone goes, there's this Irish millionaire paying this woman's legal fees.
Yeah, he forked up $2 million dollars to
He put $300,000 down on her bail, I think, you know what I mean? And to the best of my knowledge, he got Alan Dershowitz, who's a huge lawyer in the States, you know what I mean, to handle the appeal. And she got off on the appeal.
Did she? Wow.
Yeah.
And also, Bill liked beautiful women. He married a bunch of them as well, including the singer Carmel Quinn.
Carmel Quinn. Him and Carmel Quinn, again in the 60s, like in New York, they were very, very big on that Irish social circuit over there, you know, with the Kennedys and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And on St. Patrick's Day, they used to take over Carnegie Hall. And it was always packed out, but anybody who was anybody, whether it was like the chief of the police, the mayor, you know, the Kennedys, anybody with any excuse to be Irish, all went there to those shows. So he was very well got in those circles as well, you know.
Yeah, and he had booking agencies with some of the biggest names in music on them as well. A very interesting guy. All right, well, that's the guy then who owned the Crystal Ballroom.
And a bunch of other places.
All right, listen, Frank, thanks for filling us in. Good man yourself, Frank Murray.
Thank you very much, Frank.
All right, good luck. That is Frank Murray, and that is the story of Bill Fuller, and that is the bigger story of the Crystal Ballroom and McGonagall's as it was when I knew it. Okay, that's Bono talking about the Crystal Ballroom. The other song, the new song, is called Lucifer's Hands. And I'll give you just Bono talking about that before I actually play the track itself. And then we'll take a look at some of the acoustic stuff as well.
The other song is called Lucifer's Hands. And, you know, one of the strongest influences in our life was discovering the scriptures. I learned a lot about the scriptures from my friendship with the Rowans, who were this quite eccentric family from 5 Cedarwood Road. And their dad was a bit of a Bible basher, and I seem to be able to see through all the kind of nonsense and fire and brimstone stuff to the poetry and the truthfulness in the Bible. And then we met some people who were like a very ascetic Christian group. They shared their cash. They were just very idealistic people. It was called the Shalom Group. And when we were teenagers, we went out to Portran, and out there, I got baptized in the sea by a preacher called Chris Rowe, an amazing man. And, you know, it was a really deep and profound experience for myself and Edge and all of us. But so I've written this song. It's kind of playful. Lucifer's Hands. I mean, Edge has the most unbelievable riff. Without the riff, you wouldn't probably be interested in the story I've just told you.
I probably would, actually. Okay, let's hear it. Emperor's Hands is the name of the song. The Crystal Ballroom is the other one. That's the two new ones with the CD and vinyl version of Songs of Innocence out this weekend. And that's Bono talking about both. And also there's the acoustic sessions. As you know, there's about five or six or seven of the songs from the album all done in one big piece on the thing as well. And there's also an alternative version of The Troubles and Sleep Like a Baby Tonight and other stuff as well. In fact, I'll give you Bono now talking about all of that stuff in terms of just what's extra.
The other thing that's on the disc, there's another version of Sleep Like a Baby Tonight that's directed at the abused rather than the abuser. And there is a version, there's acoustic versions of five or six of the songs that you will have already heard. And again, the whole point of this is songs to prove that these things don't need studio trickery. Yeah. They don't need fireworks.
Yeah.
And, you know, sitting with Rick Rubin, who's like an angel in his presence on this album, and he would take up exactly what you just brought up, the opening of Zoo Station, which these are amazing sonic moments, and he'd say, yeah, he'd say, that's great. Some of these are amazing moments, but he says, they're not songs. He says, they're soundscapes.
Yeah.
And I love them, but he said, they're not songs. He says, your songwriting has to now raise to the level of your ability as performers to make compelling work. And it was a real challenge, and it came from him. And he said, so I know, he said, I'm a U2 fan. I asked Johnny Cash to sing one of your songs. He says, but I went through all of them. And there's a lot of your songs that only you can perform because Larry's such an extraordinary drummer, Edge is such an extraordinary guitar player, blah, blah, blah. He said, are you going to write songs that can stand up there with, you know, with the Beatles, with the Stones in their period, with the Who in their period? He said, are you going there? Are you going to go there? Because it might take you some time. Like, yeah, Rick, no problem. I can write you one in the morning. Can't write one in the morning. It just turns out maybe we're just not talented or we weren't trained like that. U2 didn't go like the Beatles to Hamburg and play cover versions for, you know, three sets a day. We didn't learn anyone else's songs. We couldn't play them, so we made up our own. You've got to create new challenges for yourself. You know, us going back into the studio with Flood and Brian Eno and creating some sonic fireworks, that's not new for you two. What might be new for you two? What might be new is eternal songs, songs that will stand on their own over there, even if you're not playing them or singing them. That's a new thing.
No, it's not. Look at some of the stuff you've done in the past.
Maybe 10.
There's at least 30 songs that will last the test of time, whatever.
Oh, yes, but our versions of them. But there's maybe only 10 songs that other people will play and they'll last forever. Yeah. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
If Dave gets it now. All right, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you... It's like as though they're sitting in front of us, actually, this track they do here now. This is going to one of the acoustic thingy-bobs. And in fact, all those years ago, the very first session we ever did across the corridor in studio weight of 1,000 bands plus with Ian Wilson was with you too. Anyway, this is up to date now. And take it away, boys. I'll be ready. 1, 2, 3, 4 acoustic version of the opening track on Songs of Innocence. Thank you very much for dropping in, guys. Nice little session. Right, there's about 5 or 6 songs from the album, as I say, acoustically, and that's them. That's 2 of them you heard there. That's the opening track, of course, on the album itself, which is The Miracle of Joey Ramone. And that's the last one of all the acoustic ones, and you heard Every Breaking Wave also in that lot there. And then you heard the two new songs, which is Lucifer's Hands and the Crystal Ballroom and the whole lot of it as well. And that's out now and all the rest of it. And by the way, there's other programs we're doing, so we'll do it too. Look, I have a vinyl copy here and I have a CD here. So if anybody wants them, I'll give them to them before the end of the programme, which is in 10 minutes' time. I'll come up with a question. We'll go right back, Crystal Ballroom time, actually. The first single was Out of Control. Name the two songs of the B-side. 51552. The two songs. And by the way, for those of you who don't know what a B-side is, you're not involved in this anyway. That's to go to people who go right back. Ask your parents what a B-side is, right? There were two songs of the B-side because you people from the Dave Fanning Rock Show decided on what would be that A-side and B-side. So what